So we can see that what I've called the destructive aspect, the anti-creative aspect of the reactive mind, can operate in all these four fields which I have mentioned. But there's another way in which this another way in which this reactive mind can be characterized. It's not just destructive. You could say it's more than destructive in a way. You could even say it's devouring. I happen to be reflecting recently on William Blake. Blake, of course, is an excellent example of a truly great artist and poet, a truly creative person, perhaps one of the most creative people that we've had in the course of the history of English art and literature. Blake, in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, distinguishes between the prolific and the devouring. I'm mainly concerned this evening with the devouring, but I'll say a few words about the prolific. The prolific is that which is enormously and constantly productive and creative. Blake is also concerned with other aspects, social, economic, and so on. I'm not concerned with those. I've noticed that many of the greatest artists, the greatest writers, were also very prolific. Not turning out just one or two little masterpieces, but perhaps dozens. One thinks, for instance, of the great Greek dramatists, of Sophocles, of Euripides, and others. Well, according to tradition, they each produced 100 or more plays. Only a fraction, of course, survive, unfortunately. And then when we come down to modern times, when we come down, say, to the painters of the Renaissance, we think of people like Titian, Tintoretto, El Greco, Rembrandt, Rubens, Michelangelo. They're so prolific. They're working all the time. Creating is happiness. They're working all the time. We come down to the great Elizabethans. We come down, for instance, to Shakespeare. Think how prolific Shakespeare was. Think how prolific, for instance, Goethe was. Think how prolific Dickens was. Think how prolific the great Russian novelists were. And if one goes to the East, well, one thinks, for instance, of a Sufi poet like Jalaluddin Rumi, how prolific he was. He was constantly producing, constantly creating, sometimes in a state of ecstasy, just dictating verse after verse after verse, thousands and thousands of verses. Couldn't stop. And in modern times in India, the great Bengali poet Rabindranath Tagore, think how endlessly creative he was. He not only produced an enormous amount of lyric poetry, but short stories, novels, plays, and as if that wasn't enough, in his old age he started painting. He produced about 2,000 paintings, and he also composed and set to music 2,000 or so songs, which are sung today all over India. So endlessly creative. So I've noticed that some of the greatest, or many of the greatest artists and poets have been very, very creative. They've been prolific. And, well, come on to meditation. Well, meditation can be prolific too. And they say, one good turn deserves another, but one good thought, one skillful thought, produces another. So the more you meditate, in the sense in which I've described, well, the more you are likely to meditate. But not just that. Meditation is prolific in another way. Because if you are a meditator, if you are creative in that particular way, you can teach meditation. So from you, other people can learn to meditate. When I started the FWBO, I was teaching mindfulness of breathing, and I was teaching the Metta Bhavana. Now since then, just because of the fact that I was not keeping my practice or experience of meditation to myself, but I was teaching it, well, hundreds, perhaps thousands of others, I've learned to meditate, have had meditative experience in that way. And meditation has become, one could say, prolific. And not only, of course, within the FWBO. Wherever meditation is taught, there is that spread. There is that creation and recreation of a certain very positive state of mind. I remember, back in the 60s, we had something called transcendental meditation. Some of you may have been around at that time. I know some of you, some of the older members, have probably come to us after practicing transcendental meditation. Well, I don't think there was anything very transcendental about it, but what was very positive about it was that at that time, and subsequently, it popularized the practice of meditation. So we can be very grateful, to the old Maharishi, Mahesh Yogi, for doing that. So we could say that meditation is inherently prolific, because once you have a meditative experience, just as when you have another positive experience, a positive experience of any kind, you want to share it with other people. So I'm very happy, to learn that here at the LBC, the meditation classes are thriving, that meditation is being taught, that more and more people are learning to meditate, are learning to be creative in that particular way in their lives. And then what about friendship? Isn't that prolific too? I was thinking about that, and I thought, well, if you make a friend, if you make a new friend, you like normally to introduce that friend to your old friend. So in that way, a sort of network of friendships grows up. You introduce your new friend to your old friends, perhaps they introduce that new friend to other friends of theirs, and in that way, a whole network of friendships is created. And I know that sometimes we speak of the FWO itself as being fundamentally a network of friendships. Network, you might say, is another name for organization. A network of friendships, of people who are in that relationship of mutual friendship, one with another. I'm reminded of that old simile which we get in one of the Mahayana Sutras, of a flame being lit from another flame, one flame being lit from another. The first flame doesn't lose anything by propagating itself in that way. And so in the same way, friendship, propagates itself. The flame of friendship passes from one person to another, and then to another, until there are all these flames, as it were, burning brightly together within what we might describe as the mandala of friendship.